isn't going to go away on Tuesday or January 20th when we figure out who's going to be the next president.
But I've read your report, your secrecy report.
Right.
It clearly shows that the amount of classified material...
billion with a B in the late 90s. Now we're spending $6.5 billion last year just keeping and maintaining the secrets that we have in government. Well, that's huge.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
I mean, we're at war. Maybe the secrets that we're keeping are necessary for national security. I mean, is that possible, or could it be political reasons here?
Absolutely. You would think that when we're at war, obviously we're going to be doing more, and we're going to want to protect more information. But there is a heck of a lot of information that we're keeping secret that we absolutely should not be. Even high-ranking Pentagon officials told Congress in an open public hearing that about half of the information that she's seen that's classified has no reason to be classified at all.
Well, actually, that doesn't seem to be coincidence. If we've doubled the amount we're classifying, now you have someone saying that half of it we don't need to classify. That actually is roughly in line. What did you think we're classifying? Give me some examples of something we're classifying that we really don't need to.
Well, let me borrow something from something that Steve Aftergood at the Federation of American Scientists found. He's an excellent analyst at this. He looked at the Senate Intelligence Report on pre-war intelligence on Iraq. And you have to remember, this is something that when this came out to the public, the CIA initially wanted to blacken out or redact about half of the report. And Trent Lott said, this is an insult and this is ridiculous. They actually got their number of redactions down to about 15%. But in the public version of the report, he found that on one page, there's... The report talks about the amount of money that Saddam Hussein is willing to pay for aluminum tubing. You remember these aluminum tubes?
Sure. George Bush talked about it in his State of the Union address.
Absolutely. Well, and so the CIA censors or redactors blacked out the amount of money that he was supposed to be willing to pay. And in the public, what you can see, it says, and this amount shows that they're putting a high priority on this, and this must, you know, be some ominous threat.
Yep.
Well, 20, 30 pages later, you find out the same language is in the report.
And how much was he willing to pay?
About $18 for aluminum tubing.
$18?
About $18 for this aluminum tubing.
You know, that's an expensive nuclear program. I mean, that's the cost of a dinner in a medium-priced restaurant.
Well, I looked up this similar kind of aluminum tubing with the same kind of aluminum on the internet, and I could get some handlebar grips for my bicycle for about $50.
Okay.
So I really wonder about this.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. I didn't realize nuclear weapons were so cheap. But apparently this $18 purchase is what the Bush administration is pointing to as Saddam Hussein trying to get nuclear weapons.
They didn't want us to know that, or at least on one page they didn't want us to know that, and on another page they thought, oh, yeah, that's fine. That doesn't have to be the case.
That's very interesting.
What we're finding is that, you know, the government doesn't have any sort of policies or any sort of guidelines, you know. We're an open society here. Our government is supposed to be open and accountable to us. We are the beacon of democracy and light and freedom and all these wonderful things that we talk about. And yet, when the government wants to keep information from us and they say, well, it's a national security reason, you know, it's a secret, you know, we want to trust that. We deserve a government that we can trust.
Rick, go ahead.
There's just no standards. It's arbitrary, it's capricious, and what you end up is with silly secrets that are kept, just like this one and just like the joke about Santa Claus. That was Santa Claus about 40 years ago. Some analyst wrote, well, you know, it was around Christmas time, and they wrote, well, you know, Santa Claus is going to be is targeted by a terrorist we're finding. You wrote this as a joke and sent it around internally. That was kept secret. That joke was kept secret.
Because Santa Claus is a threat to our security, Rick.
Absolutely. Well,
I want to go to the phones. I want to give you a chance also to call in. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. Rick Bloom is an expert at watching what the government is trying to keep secret. He's the director of OpenTheGovernment.org and OMB Watch, both organizations that are watching what the government is keeping secret and what they're not. Again, I encourage you to call in toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Rick Bloom.
Hey, Rick and Mark. Dave from California.
Hi, Dave.
I think a government with the level of credibility of this one would not want to let much of anything of what they're all about get out. But I wanted to let you know, Mark, our Patriot Act troopers are doing their thing, and hopefully it's at my end. I'm not able to hear your program. Have you verified that you're streaming?
It should be streaming. I don't know why you wouldn't be able to hear the program.
Well, can you put me on hold just a second and take another call and see if they're listening, they're able to hear it?
All right, I'll do that. Hold on one second. Actually, I don't know that we have another call that's coming in, but I will check the stream. It was working fine. I apologize for that.
You know, Mark, what I think the critical point is that there are secrets out there and there's information our government's trying to keep from the public that the public not only has a right to know, but the public really needs in order to protect their communities and make themselves safer, whether it's from, you know, what contaminants are there in our drinking water to, you know, if there's a Superfund site near your home, you know, is there something there that's going to get in your backyard and might get into your kids? This is information that the public really is trying to get and is having to go to greater and much more lengths in order to get, and it's becoming a lot harder.
So the government actually, I mean, you said Superfund sites. There, can you give me an example of something the government's keeping secret that isn't about national security but that could affect our health or the environment?
There's a case in Maryland here, in Aberdeen, Maryland. This is a town that sits right up next to an Army depot where they were testing ammunition for the Army. Well, they found that there was a rocket fuel in the drinking water, something called perchlorate. And so a citizens group got together, and they declared a Superfund site. And they started tracking where the perchlorate was in the drinking water supplies. It hadn't actually reached the tap, thankfully. And this has been going on for years, and they've been working in what they call a productive relationship with the Army. Well, 9/11 rolls around, and whoops. Now we've got a tell you the fence, we can't tell you where the maps are, we can't give you any maps of where the drinking water wells, where we're drilling to test these wells. We can't talk to the public at all, the Army said.
And of course what it does is it helps polluters pollute our water, which I'm sure, you know, they give money to the Bush campaign, but you think it'd be something we'd want to know.
And it's much more difficult for parents to figure out if their drinking water is safe.
Let me go to another caller. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Rick Bloom.
Oh, hey, Mark. It's John from New Bedford.
Is your streaming working in New Bedford, Massachusetts?
Yes, it is.
Okay. All right. That's good to hear because one caller was concerned about it.
I heard him say that.
What's your question or comment?
Well, you know, after almost 4 years, I'm spent. I'm just waiting until Tuesday till we can get rid of this guy. But I just listened to you. I'm glad to have your guest. I've been glad you're around. And, you know, nothing this administration does anymore surprises me.
You know, it is amazing. When you go through this spin, I actually thought it was very typical. It just went through the right-wing chamber. Drudge makes up something, knocked it down. It kind of, I got to say, since I know you're from New Bedford, Massachusetts, and I'm a big Red Sox fan, it just reminded me of the Red Sox. You know, Drudge comes, something comes up, swat it down. Washington Times comes, swat it down. Every pitch they give us, we're hitting out of the park because they're just making stuff up now. They're not even trying to find the truth. The whole goal is spin, spin, spin.
My wife looked at me today when they said, you know, Schilling said he was going to vote for Bush.
Yeah, I heard that.
And, you know, big deal. And my wife looked at me and she said, are people really going to, like, all of a sudden vote for Bush because the pitcher for the Red Sox, like, this was some betrayal of John Kerry's inner circle? I mean, that's like, you know, that's like saying, I mean, it's ridiculous. And
yeah.
I was like, no. I was like, the American public is smarter. You know, I was watching, I've been reading things and looking at polls and different ways, looking at the 18 to 35 poll.
Yeah.
And they're talking, I mean, I'm sorry, Mark, I'm totally off topic, so you can cut me off.
That's okay. Go, make one last point, then I'll go on.
Well, I mean, you know, the point I just saw today, I'm just going to, and I had sent it to you in an email, was that picture done by the NASA scientist who highly detailed Bush's, what was on his back.
Yeah, actually, we did a show on that a couple of weeks back about the device that may be on Bush's back. But thank you for sending that to me. And let me just encourage anyone who wants to know more about that to go to Salon.com.
Yeah.
Because the reporter has pretty clearly shown that it was something, some sort of device in Bush's back during the debate. I didn't want to believe it, but it seems like it was. Hey, thanks very much for
your
call, John. I appreciate it. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Rick Bloom.
This is Ed from New York.
Hi, Ed.
We're getting your streaming too, Mark.
Good.
But I wanted to ask Rick Bloom, what is his thoughts about the ABC news tape of the weapons that were found versus the Bush saying we've got to get the facts?
Okay, go ahead. Great.
If you're referring to the drone, the photographs that appeared in some of the news stories. Where they showed that a couple days after our troops rolled through, that there were some drums with supposedly there were these weaponry there. I think that the journalists are going to have to ask the questions. We're going to have to look at those tapes. We're going to have to get more, you know, journalists looking at that and getting more evidence and figuring out what really happened. And this just shows, you know, when the Abu Ghraib scandal came up, it took months and months and months for journalists to uncover the classified report that had been sitting around the Pentagon's desks. Talking that, and the Pentagon knew about this for months and yet hadn't done much about it.
That's a good point. I mean,
and so
you got to remember these explosives were gone in April 2003, maybe May 2003. This is a year and a half old stuff. But it's only coming to light now because of reporters, not because of any Pentagon investigation. The same is true with the Abu Ghraib scandal. Went on for months. They kept torturing people, and there was a report put out, the Tacuba report.
Right.
And it didn't come out. It was classified. We didn't know about it, and they just kept torturing people. And the amazing thing is that the government doesn't see it as its job to find out what's going on, to investigate, and to stop such things. It waits till the media brings it out. It waits, in fact, until it hurts the president politically. Remember, the president didn't want to cooperate with the 9/11 Commission until it started hurting him politically, and then that's the only time. That's the only watchdog we have.
I think that's a very insightful analysis, but I also think that there's, beyond Abu Ghraib and beyond all these high-profile events, there are some things that are below the radar that have gone on that are fundamentally changing the way the government and the public are interacting, so that we're not having as much of an open government as we used to. There are laws that are in place, and maybe we can talk about them if we have time, where it's a lot easier for industry to give information to government about what their problems are, what their vulnerabilities are, but there's no guarantees that these companies are going to fix the problems and make their communities safer.
Actually, I want to get to that in a minute, but first, I don't want to give out the phone numbers again. It's 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. And many of you know you can also contribute by going to the blog. I know a lot of you hear this show on the Internet. So when you're at www.radioinsidescoop.com, go ahead, make a comment. We'll be reading some of your comments on the air. And one comment I'd like to read comes from Nathan in Ohio, who is... he's undecided, Nathan has told us, but he's certainly in many ways leaning toward George Bush. I don't want to put words in Nathan's mouth. Let's deal with his point. Here's what he asks about what you said, Rick. He writes, last 7 years, can Mr. Bloom tell what the classifying spending was in 2000 compared to 2003 and also 1997 compared to 2000? Nathan writes, he did some quick research, which shows that from 2000 to 2001, he writes, classified documents went down while declassifying documents went up, and that in 2002, the level was almost even with the 2000 numbers. Now, you've done a lot of research on this. Is Nathan right?
Well, what we're talking about here is the amount of information that gets declassified has dropped considerably in the last 2 years. And it's probably due to 9/11.
Okay, again, I just want to be clear. Declassified has dropped.
Yes, the amount
classified
of, the amount
has
of
gone
secrets
up.
That we have, the amount of documents, pages, information that we have taken out of the classified realm, put it out into the public so that researchers and others can get to it. The government has spent a lot of time working on this, and they were declassifying in the late 90s about 200 million pages a year. There's some good numbers on that. That has dropped considerably in the last 2 years.
Now, Rick, your organization, OpenTheGovernment.org, puts out a secrecy report. I know you sent me an email.
Right.
Can that be posted on my website so people can look at the numbers themselves?
Absolutely. You can go to your website. You can link to our website. You go to OpenTheGovernment.org, and you can download the numbers yourself. He's right in that the numbers have fluctuated a bit, but this tendency toward secrecy isn't just about the Bush administration. It did start in the Clinton years. It's gotten worse with the Bush administration. And it certainly doesn't have to be this way. This is not a partisan issue. Senator Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, he used to be the attorney general there. He used to really prosecute government officials who didn't do a good job of releasing information to the public. There are a lot of examples of where Republicans and Democrats have been pushing for open government. Senator Leahy has been a longtime champion of open government. This is not a partisan issue. This is not a Republican versus Democratic issue, and it certainly isn't going away with any election, whether it's this one or the next one.
Now, is there evidence that when, for example, there's the memo, Bin Laden determined to attack the United States, which was kept secret for many, many months until the 9/11 Commission forced them to turn it over. And I know that when that happened, suddenly a document was declassified that showed one person on the 9/11 Commission, Jamie Gorelick, who had given a legal memo about the wall between the legal wall that used to exist between various parts of our department. What interests me is that the administration thought, aha, this is something that could harm Jamie Gorelick, and suddenly that memo from 1995 was declassified. Do you think that there's evidence that things are not just classified but also declassified for political reasons?
Well, I think that any time somebody has power, they're going to try to use it in their best interest. Let me give you another example of this coffin photos. These are the when our soldiers who give the ultimate sacrifice in the line of duty, you know, when they come home, since 1991, no one's been able to take their picture when they arrive at Dover Air Force Base, and all the coffins pass through Dover. Except when the administrations have felt like it's within their interest and when they want to approve reporters covering the return of these flag-draped coffins.
You know, it's hard to imagine there's a national security violation for something like that. Let me go quickly. We only got a few minutes left. Let me go back to Dave. Dave, apparently all my other listeners tell me the stream is working. Apparently it's not John Ashcroft unless he's out to get you, which is possible.
Oh, it happens at my end all the time.
It's possible, but...
He didn't shut you down.
No, he did not shut me down. Everyone else seems to be able to get the streaming. So let me just get back to you, and we only got a few minutes left. What's your question for me or for Rick Bloom?
Well, it is my opinion that our government has been stolen by robber barons, and I don't think they want that to be known to the citizens. They are trying to crush our middle class. They are trying to destroy our environment. Why would they not want to make everything secret that they possibly could?
It's a strong point. Thanks very much for your call.
Rick,
all right, Mark. We only got 1 minute left or so. If citizens want a more open government, what can they do?
Well, first of all, they can go on our website and sign up and take part in the democratic process.
That's openthegovernment.org.
Yes, and they can, you know, tell our leaders that this is an important issue. There hasn't been an oversight hearing in Congress on the Freedom of Information Act in years. Someone told me it was 12 years. You know, it's critical that we have an open government, and we need leaders in Congress, in the executive branch, and we need leaders in the court system who really want to ensure that the public can get access to the information from government and hold their government accountable.
In fact, some of my sources tell me that the Bush administration is intentionally slowing down Freedom of Information Act requests, giving out partial information, not giving out complete information, and that we will find out if there's a Kerry presidency. That, in fact, some 2,000 Iraqis have already been killed by our troops. This, by the way, I got from a very good source. There is a lot of information the government is not giving out, and I would have to say the best way to support open government is, one, certainly support people like Rick Bloom at OpenTheGovernment.org, but another way is simply to have one party watch the other. I don't care whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. If you've got a Republican Congress and a Democratic president, that Congress is going to watch that president. You're going to have investigations like we had in Iran-Contra, watching to see that malfeasance is going on. It looks to me, I'm sorry to say, like we're going to be having a Republican Congress after the next election, certainly the House, probably the Senate, and the only way to ensure an open government is, in fact, to elect a Democratic president. Thanks, Rick, very much for your participation in this. I really appreciate you coming here on the Inside Scoop.
Thank you. It was fun.
Okay, listen, we're going to come back after commercial break. We're going to have David Marist. He is a Marine, ex-Marine. He's a journalist. And what he has to tell us is that the munitions in Iraq, it's not just about the 380 tons of explosives. There are hundreds of thousands of weapons, munitions out there that are going to our terrorist enemies that didn't used to belong to the terrorists. Also, when we come back, I'm going to play for you the exclusive, well, it's not exclusive to me, but the exclusive to KSTP, the local Minneapolis news that actually was embedded with the troops and saw, without a doubt, there's no way to doubt it, that our troops broke the IAEA seal, found the explosives inside, and left them open to Iraqi looters. I am not blaming the troops, all right? I am doing what John Kerry did in Vietnam. I am blaming the commanders, beginning with the commander-in-chief, who didn't order our troops to secure those weapons. That's not the troops' fault. It is the fault of those who planned this war at the Bush administration. We're going to play that news report when we come back. We'll also take your calls and your comments on the blog. 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back.
brains in gear. Today's goober goes to Washington lobbyist Frank Keating. He's the former right-wing governor of Oklahoma who tried to get a top political job in the Bush regime, but ethical problems disqualified him. So Frank sank to a lower ethical strata, hiring on to hustle legislative favors for life insurance corporations. Appallingly, Frank recently stood up for several insurance firms that are engaged in a shabby insider deal to fleece young American soldiers who are on their way to war in Iraq. Often posing as military instructors in personal finance, insurance agents from these corporations have duped unwitting young troops into buying rip-off life insurance policies that are unneeded and nearly worthless. It's an abominable, totally unethical act of war profiteering. But here came Keating, the industry mouthpiece, to blame the victims. Someone who is mature enough to fight and quite possibly die for their country should be freely able to decide how much and what kind of life insurance they should have, he said. What a goober. He knows that this is not about free markets or free will. These low-ranking soldiers are set up for the insurance predators. The sales pitch often comes as part of compulsory military classes. The soldiers are not even told they're buying insurance, and many of the insurance agents are retired military officers. These 18, 19, 20-year-old soldiers, conditioned to obeying the commands of senior officers, believe that retired Colonel so-and-so is telling them something they must do, so they sign without questioning. Their officers believe that retired Colonel so-and-so is telling them something they must do, so they sign without questioning. This is Jim Hightower saying, yet Keating is still lobbying Congress to let his corporate clients continue picking the pockets of the underpaid grunts heading to Iraq. Is this the freedom they're being asked to die for? I'm Jim Hightower, and I've approved this message.
Jim Hightower is not running for office, but he is back this campaign season with an important word about the regime of King George V.
Let's stop beating around the bush. These people are nuts.
Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush is Hightower's hilarious new best-selling book, offering you unvarnished facts, insight, and humor to get you through this year's political spin cycle. Buy Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush today and make politics fun again. Available at bookstores everywhere and on the web at jimhightower.com. Buy it today.
38%.
An ex-Marine and a journalist who's going to be telling us, I believe, that the 380 tons are just a small sample of the missing munitions ordnance in Iraq. I want to read from the website. I know that Rex has contributed to the blog, and Rex points out we should check out the Channel 5 commentary on the previous day's blog. This is Channel 5 from Minneapolis, KSTP, whose breaking story really is putting the Pentagon to real bind. Rex writes, if corroborated, they had complete knowledge, they meaning our troops, had complete knowledge 9 days after the fall of Baghdad. Also, W's argument that we had destroyed 400,000 tons to a mere 380 tons missing is very misleading. And I quote, 400,000 tons of ordnance. The term ordnance is key here, Rex points out. It includes shell casings, propellants, the weight of any delivery systems, etc. Note that the Channel 5's newscast showed nothing but high explosives and primers, perfect for IEDs, these explosive devices. I've been wondering where the insurgents were getting all that stuff. Now I know. While Bush has far too few soldiers holding far too few cities, the terrorists are walking around an unguarded outpost picking it up. And I want to play for you the update from Channel 5 News in Minneapolis. Listen in.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Cindy Brucato. Attention from around the world. Focus tonight on a video taken by a Five Eyewitness News crew embedded with U.S. troops. On April 18, 2003, our cameras captured troops locating an arsenal of unsecured explosives. The materials were found by the 101st Airborne in or near Al-Qaqah, the same region where tons of explosives are missing tonight. Our team coverage includes a live report from the Pentagon, but let's start out at the bunker and break down the...
We've now showed this tape to a number of experts all across the country. Still pictures from the video also. Senate Armed Services Committee has a copy of it right now. And tonight, specific, found in Iraq after the fall of Baghdad.
Our crew and the soldiers from the 101st Airborne they were with found dozens of these. They're called boosters. Explosives that are used in mining and quarrying. Experts tell us this appears to be sticks of military-grade dynamite. And this box caught one expert's eye. First, because it bears the words Al-Qaqah State Establishment. but also because it weighs 49.3 kilograms.
The cases are clearly marked as weighing 49.3 kilograms, which is a little over 100 pounds. The barrels, I presume, are 100-pound barrels of explosive also. So you're talking about thousands and thousands of pounds of explosives here.
And that's enough to make hundreds of 300 to 400-pound car bombs that experts say insurgents in Iraq are making.
These pictures are pretty dramatic proof that the high explosives were there after Baghdad fell.
It wasn't quantity that impressed this physicist, but quality. This box, one of hundreds, by the way, is marked 1.1D, an indicator of a high explosive. But here, this bunker.
But that makes me nervous there. Look, the lead seal. Quality seal.
This one's going to be harder to get into.
This has been identified as a seal placed by inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency. Those inspectors historically sealed bunkers containing only the most powerful munitions.
The fact that there's a photo of what looks like an IAEA seal means that what's behind those doors is HMX.
HMX is one of the most powerful explosives in the world. Our crew looked through the window of this sealed bunker, but did not go in. Physicist David Albright, who looked at our video, is known as a frequent critic of Bush war policy. The easy access soldiers had to the bunkers and the way they left them hasn't changed that.
When they left, they didn't lock the door, and they didn't post a guard at the bunker. And so I think any Iraqi could have also cut the seal and cut the chain link or the chain around the door.
Now, the 101st Airborne tells us and has told us all along they had a perimeter set up around the area of the bunkers. However, the Airborne never had specific orders to guard the bunkers. Their orders were to get to Baghdad as soon as they could. What our crew saw was thousands of pounds of munitions, and our crew that was on the ground in Iraq has no idea what happened to it. Cindy, when they left the area, as they continued their coverage of the war in Iraq, they assumed the munitions were still there.
Well, the fallout, so to speak, is still continuing on this.
Did you hear that? They got no orders to destroy the munitions or to even secure the site. So please, Rudolph Giuliani, stop blaming our troops. It's not their fault that they didn't get the orders. And it's not just about Al-Qaeda. As David Morris, ex-Marine journalist, is reporting, it's about a lot more than Al-Qaeda. I want to welcome him to the program. If you want to call in toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP. David Morris, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
It's my pleasure, Mark.
Now, you've reported, I want to get this straight, it's not just about Al-Qaeda, is it?
No, and I think any Iraqi insurgent that happened to watch that clip would kind of be laughing. Because, you know, Al-Qaeda is certainly an important weapon site, but there are hundreds of unsecured weapon sites across Iraq.
Hundreds?
Yes. You know, possibly upwards of thousands. There are, you know, over 600,000 tons of ordnance that have been distributed across the country during Saddam's regime. We have only a limited picture of the status and, you know, state of security and who actually has possession of all these different weapon systems at this point.
Okay, now, of course, there's all kinds of ordnance, as one of our listeners pointed out. There's, you know, run-of-the-mill bullets, I guess, and bullet casings, all the way up to this HMX, this very powerful plastic explosive. How much ordnance is really very dangerous to us in the hands of terrorists?
Well, most of the weapons that we're talking about, the ammunition and munitions we're talking about, is relatively easily convertible into car bombs or roadside bombs. You know, the HMX and RDX that was at Al-Qaeda was, you know, more concentrated form. It was a powderized form of those two substances. But all you're doing when you when you're making a high explosive device is for the most part adding some sort of a stabilizer or a plasticizer to those pure explosives, and then, you know, casting it into a bomb casing. So it's, you know, they're more pure form. But to infer that these other munition dumps are devoid of useful military material is false.
Okay, now how do we know that all this stuff, one, was there in the first place, and two, is no longer there now?
Well, I had the opportunity to tour a weapons facility on the scale of Al-Qaeda. It didn't have pure HMX and RDX in it, but it had thousands of various different weapon systems, aviation bombs, mines, torpedoes, 6,000-pound Chinese air-dropped bombs, and they briefed me, on the various different sites that this engineering group was slowly demilitarizing and disposing of. And there were 103 just in western Iraq that they happened to be aware of. And I asked them how many were secured, and they weren't able to give me a solid figure. And it's not to say that they're doing a poor job, but they're just disposing of what the sites they know of as they become aware of them. And it's, there's simply not enough men on the ground to adequately, guard these facilities 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It would chew up an inordinate amount of manpower to do that.
Yeah, should we have known about these facilities before we went in and brought in more troops to do that? I mean, is that something that we knew about?
We had an understanding, and anybody who knew anything about Saddam's regime could tell you that they had an extensive amount of ordnance that had to be distributed across the country. But no one really fully understood until we got there, myself included. And I was shocked when I saw the scope and scale of the problem that we're looking at, because it's not just a case of, there are, several hundred facilities fenced off, in these, certain bunkers. There are hundreds of different munitions dumps of varying degrees of, quality. Not all of them are accounted for. The Baathists weren't like Nazis where they kept great records about where everything was. They distributed this stuff. It's in schoolhouses. It's in open canyons. It's in, a traditional bunker, concrete, thick-walled bunker. The facility I visited was basically just a large desert canyon with, bombs distributed up the course of this canyon with no overhead cover. And, there were dogs running around inside the facility, and, it was essentially exposed to open air.
Now, to what extent have we destroyed this ordnance and put it out of use, and to what extent is that still available? The Bush administration is now saying, well, we destroyed a number of tons of ordnance. I'm sure they did. How much have we destroyed versus how much is left?
Well, the Bush administration is quoting this figure, 400,000 tons. I believe that figure to be false. The officers in charge that I spoke with, who were in charge of all of the Al-Anbar munition sites, which is the largest state in Iraq. It comprises the western third of the country. And as of August of this year, they had disposed of 12% of everything that was in there.
So 88%, at least in that sector, was what happened to it? Are we watching it? Are we securing it? Is Al-Qaqa the exception, or is it the rule?
I would say it's more the rule. They have a very set schedule that they're working on towards disposing all of this ordnance, but it's a very lengthy, very labor-intensive and detailed process to get this done, which was further worsened by the fact that a lot of troops, when different units passed through during the initial conquest phase of Iraq, they would find weapons caches and attempt to blow them in place so they didn't have to deal with this kind of thing in their rear. And they blew up these sites oftentimes improperly and just distributed the unexploded ordnance across a wider area. So it's a very, very intensive, very, very time-consuming process to pick apart and demilitarize all of Iraq.
The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. Let me ask you this. If the 88% or so has not been destroyed, how much of that is being watched by our troops to make sure that terrorists don't get it, and how much of it is just left unsecured for anyone to walk in and pick up what they want?
Well, I can't give you an exact figure, Mark. I'm not familiar with each and every site in Iraq and how they're going about dealing with them.
Tell me what you saw in the western portion.
But what I can tell you is that it's the sites are so widespread and so difficult to keep a handle on, and we simply don't have enough troops to monitor them or to safeguard them on a continual basis. So I would say the number that are actually guarded is relatively few, perhaps definitely well less than half
and probably a
quarter.
Less than half, and you think it's a quarter. Now, some will argue, I know Bush supporters who supported the war in Iraq will say, well, now, wait a minute. If Saddam Hussein had this ordnance, he didn't have weapons of mass destruction. That's pretty well confirmed. He didn't have chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons. But he did have some powerful conventional weapons. These at Al-Qaqa, they were under UN seal, so he couldn't use those. But he did have lots of weapons, as you've pointed out, huge numbers, that maybe that was a reason to invade, because Saddam Hussein would otherwise give them to terrorists. My question for you, David, is do you think that it was more likely for Saddam Hussein to get those weapons to terrorists, or do you think it's more likely that because of our actions in Iraq, terrorists have those weapons?
Well, it's important to keep in mind that Saddam, is a totalitarian state, and so in order to maintain power there, one of the primary ways was to, deny arms and explosives to anybody who hates you. You know, this is a republic based on fear, and Saddam, it was in his best interest to keep a tight watch on any explosives that he had inside the country. So I think they had a much better, handle on this situation than we currently do. Saddam did train Palestinian suicide bombers in his country, but it remains to be proven that he actually equipped them. They trained them, but they weren't shipping them out with explosives. So I think the ironic thing is that because, due in part to the fact that the Baathists didn't keep particularly good records and we don't have a perfect situational awareness of all the different explosives depots, across the country, that, the situation now is more anarchic. There's more unaccounted for weapon systems than there might have been under Saddam's regime. It's sort of ironic.
I want to play for you and for our listeners, David, a report from CNN that bases it on that Minneapolis reporters, local reporters report. We talked earlier in the program about all the various excuses. It's Russia's fault. The Washington Times had an excuse. Matt Drudge had an excuse. Dick Cheney had an excuse. All of them were proven false. And now that we have this Minneapolis reporters report, the Pentagon's in a bit of a bind. In fact, I saw a press conference just about an hour before I went on the air where they had a guy from the military, I think he's from the Army, stand up there and say, yeah, we destroyed lots of ordnance. And the reporters would say, was it the ordnance in Al-Qaqa? And he'd say, we destroyed ordnance near Al-Qaqa. And he said, well, was it the ordnance that was controlled by the IAEA, the HMX, under the seal? And finally he had to concede, well, no, it wasn't that ordnance. This report from this Minneapolis report is really putting the Pentagon in a bind. Let me play for you just this part from CNN.
The Pentagon's argument that the stockpile of powerful HMX explosive was likely long gone from the Al-Qaqa facility when U.S. troops arrived in April of 2003 was seriously undercut by this video, shot by Minneapolis television station KSTP. Reporter Dean Staley was embedded with soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division when they entered a locked bunker at the Al-Qaqa facility on April 18, 2003, nearly a month into the war. But to get in, they cut what now appears to be an International Atomic Energy Agency seal.
We thought it might have been some sort of booby trap because it was such a thin wire, but we broke the lock and broke that wire to get in.
That IAEA seal, arms experts tell CNN, is the strongest evidence yet that at least some of the missing explosives were inside, because HMX was the only material placed under seal at Al-Qaqa. And the reporter says the troops he was with were on an unofficial mission, just looking around. They were not searching for or securing any material. There was, he said, nothing to stop anyone from looting.
And some of the bunkers weren't even locked. I mean, we had to break a couple of padlocks to get into some of them. Others we did not. They were wide open. We also saw Iraqis at the time driving around in a pickup truck, an old beat-up pickup truck, clearly scavenging. I mean, clearly sort of looking around. We kept an eye on them because this was sort of no man's land.
The revelation came on a day when the Pentagon released this satellite photograph taken on March 17, 2003, a few days before the war began. It shows a truck and heavy equipment transporter outside one bunker that is not believed to have contained HMX. But the Pentagon admits the photograph is inconclusive, showing only there was activity at the site and not that any explosives were moved. Still, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, in a series of radio interviews, repeated the Pentagon's contention that it's unlikely the stockpile could have been looted after the U.S. got there.
We had total control of the air. We would have seen anything like that. So the idea that it was suddenly looted and moved out, all of these tons of equipment, is I think, at least debatable. And it's very likely that, just as the United States would do, that Saddam Hussein moved munitions when he knew the war was coming.
The Pentagon says the video is just another piece in the puzzle as it tries to reconstruct what happened to what the IAEA now says is more than 360 tons, not 380 tons, of missing high explosives. Still unclear is whether any was stolen or successfully destroyed by U.S. troops.
And if there are any doubts at all in your mind that maybe something went wrong at Al-Qaqa, Just listen to United States Weapons Inspector David Kay on this very issue.
And last night on Newsnight with Aaron Brown, David Kay went further, suggesting that if this videotape is authentic from this Minneapolis local television station and U.S. troops went in there and broke those seals, it's all over. The U.S. was responsible as a result for those missing explosives. Listen precisely once again to David Kay.
Well, at least with regard to this one bunker, and the film shows one SEAL, one bunker, one group of soldiers going through, and there were others there that were sealed. With this one, I think it is game, set, and match. There was HMX, RDX in there.
Well, you heard it. I don't know how they're going to try to get their way out of this one. David, let me ask you, what is the answer? Okay, we've messed up. We were there. We could have stopped these explosives from going out. They had the IAEA seal. They're gone now. They're who knows where. What can we do now? Is there anything left that we can do?
In this situation with Iraq, it's important to keep in mind that these insurgents that we're fighting, you know, and will continue to fight for some time, have access to this type of equipment, and we need to shut it off. You know, outside of it being a political issue, this is an issue that threatens the welfare of our troops that are over there.
Well, when you say shut it off, are there still sites today that are unsecured that we need to secure right now?
Absolutely. And from what I can tell, you know, and I'm not on the ground in Iraq right now, but based on the evidence that I have seen and the inferences that can be made, there's a huge amount of unsecured ammunition right now. And the reason is a little bit elusive. Because, you know, it's not a particularly sexy job. It doesn't appear to be something that will win the war, you know, just go secure some munition sites. But, you know, it's important to keep in mind with these guerrilla-type warfare situations, if you deny a potential insurgent any weapons or explosives, he is merely an angry farmer. I mean, they have to, this is an ad hoc scratch team that we're fighting in many cases. And they have to go out and find and buy or steal the weapons to go kill Americans.
David, do we have any information to suggest that the weapons that are being used, there's some 80 attacks on U.S. troops every single day in Iraq. Doesn't get much news anymore because I guess it's old news. Do we have any evidence that any of these 80 attacks are based on these unsecured munitions?
Well, Al-Qaqa, I can't say, but it's, you know, it appears, you know, I've spoken to experts that were there. Researchers with the U.S. Army that were there right after the fall of Baghdad, and there was a lull shortly after Baghdad fell before attacks really began. And there was a time when it was before the roadside bomb and the car bomb really became the weapon of choice. And, you know, you could argue that was perhaps an issue of the enemy not being organized or hierarchy set up. You know, I think another part of the equation is validated and began, locating and exploiting different weapon sites that were out there. That they're out there, stealing arms and equipment, you know, as we speak.
David's article about this, by the way, is on Salon.com. You can find it there and read about it. David, I promised I'd give you a chance to tell our listeners about your book.
Right. Yeah. The book is it's called Storm on the Horizon. It's about the first battle of the 91 Gulf War. And it kind of provides sort of a contrasting example from the current situation we're in, where the U.S. military had a chance to work with a larger coalition with Arab allies to kick Saddam out of Saudi Arabia. He actually in 91 he invaded Saudi Arabia and captured a small town there. So it's kind of an interesting contrast to this current situation to see how. When the military is given the proper tools and the proper mission, how they can operate.
It's called Storm the Horizon?
Storm on the Horizon.
Storm on the Horizon. It's by David Morris. You can find it in bookstores or on Amazon.com. Thanks very much, David, for coming here on the Inside Scoop.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
We just got a couple minutes left. I want to answer a couple questions that are here. We will be having a show Sunday. I know it's Halloween, but hey, it's 6 Eastern time earlier across the nation. You might be able to listen in. I want to talk about fear and how, after all, it is Halloween, and how the Bush administration has used fear to really scare people into voting for him. We're also going to talk about the news. I do want to respond very, very quickly to two comments that I've gotten during the show. One is by Michael Ryan. Ryan asks, what happens if on Election Day Kerry and Edwards are winning and there's a terrorist strike and they're killed, God forbid? What's the law? Who would be president? Well, Michael, if it happens before December 6th last year, it's probably around that week this year. It's the first Monday, I believe, in December, which is when the Electoral College meets. The Democratic electors, if John Kerry wins the election, he's got, let's say, 272 Democratic electors, then they could meet and decide whoever they want. So they would get together, presumably they, and decide amongst themselves and then hold together as a group and elect who knows, Howard Dean or Wesley Clark or some other Democrat. If it happened after December 6th, then, of course, Kerry and Edwards would have already been the president-elect. That's a much tougher issue. Probably that they could re-meet, or it might have to go to the third in charge, which is the Speaker of the House, Denny Hastert. Nathan writes, when he talked about the fact that we need to have a by the way, I'm going to go over here for our internet listeners. For all you on WAGE, thank you for listening to the Inside Scoop. Tune in Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. For internet listeners, I want to answer the question of Nathan from Ohio. Nathan, you said that you also agree in divided government and that it would make the difference for you in voting for Kerry if you thought there would be a Republican Senate. Well, let's talk about that. Right now, there are 51 Republican senators, 49 Democrats, actually 48 Democrats and independent Jeffords, who votes with the Democrats. And here, there are really only 9 seats that are likely to change hands, that even have a chance, I should say, of changing hands. Illinois will almost certainly go from Republican to Democrat. Barack Obama is going to win that hands down. Georgia will almost certainly go from Democrat to Republican. Zell Miller was, in fact, a Republican in all but name anyway, so it hardly matters that becomes a Republican seat. But again, when Illinois and Georgia switch seats, we're still left with a 51-49 Republican Senate. Now, there are 3 Republican seats that could be lost in Alaska, Kentucky, and Colorado. There are 4 Democratic seats that could be lost: South Carolina, North Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana. We'll talk more about this on Sunday. But the sum and substance is, when you add up all the numbers and do all the math, you find that there's 48 Republican seats that will absolutely occur and 45 Democratic seats that will absolutely occur. For the Democrats to take the Senate, they would need to win 5 of the 7 seats in play. So I think that's kind of hard to do. I think it's actually likely the Republicans will contain the Senate. It's certainly possible, but I think no one disputes that the House will be Republican. So if that convinces you, Nathan, to vote for Kerry, then, hey, maybe you'll just vote for Kerry. Listen in Sunday. We're going to talk more about all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know, and specifically a Halloween special on how this administration is trying to scare you. That's all we have for now. Tune in Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, for another edition of the Inside Scoop.